9. Do we have early testimony about Jesus? Historical evidence moves us a long way towards demonstrating our belief. As a result, the faith that is necessary to fill in the remaining gap is reasonable. Craig Blomberg. The Gospel According to Non-Christians. In AD 66, Jews in Palestine initiated a revolt against Roman rule that, to put it mildly, the Romans did not appreciate. The emperor sent troops led by General Vespasian to squash the rebellion and regain control of rebel areas. In 67, Vespasian laid siege to the rebel town of Jotapata in Galilee. In the 47th day of that siege, a young Jewish revolutionary chose to surrender to the superior Roman army rather than commit suicide, a fate many of his countrymen had chosen. That young man won favor with Vespasian and was later taken to Rome by General Titus, Vespasian's son, after Titus destroyed Jerusalem and the Jewish temple in 70. That young man was Flavius Josephus, circa 37 to circa 100, who ultimately became the greatest Jewish historian of his time. Josephus began his historical writings in Rome while serving as a historian for the Roman Emperor Domitian. It was there that he authored his autobiography and two major historical works. One of those works is his now famous Antiquities of the Jews, which he finished in about AD 93. In Book 18, Chapter 3, Section 3 of that work, Josephus, who was not a Christian, wrote these words. At this time, the time of Pilate, there was a wise man who was called Jesus. His conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and the other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die, but those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah, concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. That wasn't Josephus's only mention of Jesus. In another passage from Antiquities, Josephus revealed how the new high priest of the Jews, Ananus the Younger, took advantage of a gap in Roman rule to kill James, the brother of Jesus. It was AD 62, and the Roman governor Festus died suddenly in office. 3 months elapsed before his successor Albinus could get to Judea, allowing ample time for Ananus to do his dirty work. Josephus describes the incident this way. Festus was now dead, and Albinus was but upon the road, so he, Ananus the high priest, assembled the Sanhedrin of the judges, and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, or some of his companions. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. So here we have not only another first-century reference to Jesus, but confirmation that he had a brother named James, who obviously was not well-liked by the Jewish authorities. Could it be that James was martyred because he was the leader of the Jerusalem church, as the New Testament implies? Just how many non-Christian sources are there that mention Jesus? Including Josephus, there are 10 known non-Christian writers who mention Jesus within 150 years of his life. By contrast, over the same 150 years, there are 9 non-Christian sources who mention Tiberius Caesar, the Roman emperor, at the time of Jesus. So, discounting all the Christian sources, Jesus is actually mentioned by one more source than the Roman emperor. If you include the Christian sources, authors mentioning Jesus outnumber those mentioning Tiberius 43-10. Some of these non-Christian sources, such as Celsus, Tacitus, and the Jewish Talmud, could be considered anti-Christian sources. While these works do not have any eyewitness testimony that contradicts events described in the New Testament documents, they are works written by writers whose tone is decidedly anti-Christian. What can we learn from them and the more neutral non-Christian sources? We learn that they admit certain facts about early Christianity that help us piece together a storyline that is surprisingly congruent with the New Testament. Piecing together all 10 non-Christian references, we see that 1. Jesus lived during time of Tiberius Caesar. 2. He lived a virtuous life. 3. He was a wonder worker. 4. He had a brother named James. 5. He was acclaimed to be the Messiah. 6. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate. 7. He was crucified on the eve of the Jewish Passover. 8. Darkness and an earthquake occurred when he died. 9. His disciples believed he rose from the dead. 10. His disciples were willing to die for their belief. 11. Christianity spread rapidly as far as Rome. 12. His disciples denied the Roman gods and worshipped Jesus as God. In light of these non-Christian references, the theory that Jesus never existed is clearly unreasonable. How could non-Christian writers collectively reveal a storyline congruent with the New Testament if Jesus never existed? But the implications run even deeper than that. What does this say about the New Testament? On the face of it, non-Christian sources affirm the New Testament. While the non-Christian authors don't say they believe in the resurrection, they report that the disciples certainly believed it. Since, as we have shown, the existence of God and the possibility of miracles is firmly established through natural revelation, and the general story of Christ and the early church is affirmed through non-Christian sources, did the miracles of Christ actually occur as the disciples claim? Do the New Testament documents record actual history? Could it be that they are not biased religious writings full of myths and fables, as many in our modern world assume, but instead describe events that actually occurred about 2,000 years ago? If so, we'll be well on our way to discovering which theistic religion is true. To see if the New Testament is a record of actual history, we need to answer two questions concerning the documents that comprise the New Testament. 1. Do we have accurate copies of the original documents that were written down in the first century? 2. Do those documents speak the truth? In order to believe the New Testament message, both of those questions must be answered in the affirmative. It's not enough just to give evidence that we have an accurate copy of the original first century documents, question 1, because those documents could be telling lies. We must have an accurate copy of the documents and have reason to believe that those documents describe what really happened nearly 2,000 years ago. Question 2. Let's begin with question 1. Question 1. Do we have an accurate copy? We're sure you remember the child's game of telephone. That's where one child is given a verbal message to pass to the next child, who passes what he's heard to the next child, and so on. By the time the message gets to the last child in the chain, it barely resembles what the first kid was told. To the casual observer, it seems like that same type of distortion could infect documents that have been transmitted from generation to generation over 2,000 years. Fortunately, the New Testament was not transmitted that way. Since it was not told to one person who told it to another and so on, the problem from the telephone game does not apply. Numerous people independently witnessed New Testament events, many of them committed it to memory, and 9 of those eyewitnesses, contemporaries, put their observations in writing. At this point, we need to clear up a common misunderstanding about the New Testament. When we speak of the New Testament documents, we are not talking about one writing, but about 27 writings. The New Testament documents are 27 different documents that were written on 27 different scrolls by 9 different writers over a 20 to 50 year period. These individual writings have since been collected into one book we now call the Bible. So the New Testament is not just one source, but a collection of sources. There's only one problem. So far, none of the original written documents of the New Testament have been discovered. We have only copies of the original writings, called manuscripts. Will this prevent us from knowing what the originals said? Not at all. In fact, all significant literature from the ancient world is reconstructed into its original form by comparing the manuscripts that survive. To reconstruct the original, it helps to have a large number of manuscripts that are written not long after the original. More manuscripts and earlier manuscripts usually provide more trustworthy testimony and enable a more accurate reconstruction. How do the New Testament documents fare in this regard? Extremely well, and far better than anything else from the ancient world. In fact, the New Testament documents have more manuscripts, earlier manuscripts, and more abundantly supported manuscripts than the best 10 pieces of classical literature combined. Here's what we mean. more manuscripts. At last count, there are nearly 5,700 handwritten Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. In addition, there are more than 9,000 manuscripts in other languages, for example, Syriac, Coptic, Latin, Arabic. Some of these nearly 15,000 manuscripts are complete Bibles, others are books or pages, and a few are just fragments. As shown in Figure 9-1 on the next page, there is nothing from the ancient world that even comes close in terms of manuscript support. The next closest work is the Iliad by Homer with 643 manuscripts. Most other ancient works survive on fewer than a dozen manuscripts, yet few historians question the historicity of the events those works describe. Earlier manuscripts. Not only does the New Testament enjoy abundant manuscript support, but it also has manuscripts that were written soon after the originals. The earliest undisputed manuscript is a segment of John, chapter 18, verses 31 to 33 and 37 to 38, known as the John Rylands fragment, because it's housed in the John Rylands Library in Manchester, England. Scholars date it between AD 117 to 138, but some say it is even earlier. It was found in Egypt, across the Mediterranean from its probable place of composition in Asia Minor, demonstrating that John's gospel was copied and had spread quite some distance by the early 2nd century. Even earlier than the John Rylands fragment are 9 disputed fragments that date from AD 50 to 70, found with the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some scholars believe these fragments are parts of 6 New Testament books, including Mark, Acts, Romans, 1 Timothy, 2 Peter, and James. While other scholars resist this conclusion, perhaps because its admission would undermine their liberal leanings that the New Testament was written later, they have not found any other non-New Testament texts that these fragments could be. Figure 9-1. Reliability of the New Testament compared to other ancient documents. Time gap in years between original and first surviving copies. New Testament, 25. Homer, 500. Demosthenes, 1400. Herodotus, 1400. Plato, 1200. Tacitus, 1000. Caesar, 1000. Pliny, 750. Number of manuscript copies. New Testament, 5,686. Homer, 643. Demosthenes, 200. Herodotus, 8. Plato, 7. Tacitus, 20. Caesar, 10. Pliny, 7. The fragments were found in a cave that had previously been identified as containing material from 50 BC to AD 50. The scholar who first identified these early fragments as New Testament books was José O'Callaghan, a noted Spanish paleographer. The New York Times recognized the implications of O'Callaghan's theory by admitting that if it is true, it would prove at least one of the Gospels, that of St. Mark, was written only a few years after the death of Jesus. But even if they are not true New Testament fragments, and the John Rylands fragment really is the earliest, the time gap between the original and the first surviving copy is still vastly shorter than anything else from the ancient world. The Iliad has the next shortest gap at about 500 years. Most other ancient works are 1,000 years or more from the original. The New Testament gap is about 25 years and maybe less. This does not mean there were no other manuscripts between the original and the first copy. There most certainly were. It simply means that those manuscripts have decayed, have been destroyed, or are still undiscovered. How old are the oldest surviving manuscripts of complete New Testament books? Manuscripts that are complete New Testament books survive from about AD 200. How about the oldest manuscripts of the entire New Testament? Most of the New Testament, including all of the Gospels, survives from 250. And a manuscript of the entire New Testament, including a Greek Old Testament, called Codex Vaticanus, survives from about 325. Several other complete manuscripts survive from that century, and those manuscripts have spelling and punctuation characteristics that suggest they are in a family of manuscripts that can be traced back to AD 100 to 150. If these numerous and early manuscripts were all scholars had, they could reconstruct the original New Testament with great accuracy. But they also have abundant supporting evidence from the ancient world that makes New Testament reconstruction even more certain. Let's look at that next. More abundantly supported manuscripts. Beginning in February of AD 303, the Roman Emperor Diocletian ordered 3 edicts of persecution upon Christians because he believed that the existence of Christianity was breaking the covenant between Rome and her gods. The edicts called for the destruction of churches, manuscripts, and books, and the killing of Christians. Hundreds, if not thousands, of manuscripts were destroyed across the Roman Empire during this persecution, which lasted until AD 311. But even if Diocletian had succeeded in wiping every biblical manuscript off the face of the earth, he could not have destroyed our ability to reconstruct the New Testament. Why? Because the early church fathers, men of the 2nd and 3rd centuries, such as Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Tertullian, and others, quoted the New Testament so much, 36,289 times to be exact, that all but 11 verses of the New Testament can be reconstructed just from their quotations. In other words, you could go down to your local public library, check out the works of the early church fathers, and read nearly the entire New Testament just from their quotations of it. So we not only have thousands of manuscripts, but thousands of quotations from those manuscripts. This makes reconstruction of the original text virtually certain. But how certain? How are the originals reconstructed, and how accurate is this reconstructed New Testament? How is the original reconstructed? These 3 facts, many early and supported manuscripts, help scholars reconstruct the original New Testament manuscripts rather easily. The process of comparing the many copies and quotations allows an extremely accurate reconstruction of the original, even if errors were made during copying. How does this work? Consider the following example. Suppose we have 4 different manuscripts that have 4 different errors in the same verse, such as Philippians chapter 4, verse 13, "I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength." Here are the hypothetical copies. 1. "I can do all T space I-N-G-S through Christ who gives me strength." 2. "I can do all T-H space N-G-S through Christ who gives me strength." 3. "I can do all THI space GS through Christ who gives me strength." 4. "I can do all THIN space S through Christ who gives me strength." Is there any mystery what the original said? None whatsoever. By the process of comparing and cross-checking, the original New Testament can be reconstructed with great accuracy. And the reconstruction of the New Testament is easier than this, because there are far fewer errors in the actual New Testament manuscripts than are represented by this example. Let's assume for a minute that the New Testament really is the Word of God. Skeptics may ask, well, if the New Testament really is the Word of God, then why didn't God preserve the original? We can only speculate here, but one possibility is because His Word might be better protected through copies than through original documents. How so? Because if the original were in someone's possession, that person could change it. But if there are copies spread all over the ancient world, there's no way one scribe or priest could alter the Word of God. As we have seen, the process of reconstruction allows variants and changes from copies to be identified and corrected rather easily. So, ironically, not having the originals may preserve God's Word better than having them. How accurate is the reconstruction? In order to address the issue of accuracy, we need to clear up misunderstandings many critics have concerning errors in the biblical manuscripts. Some have estimated there are about 200,000 errors in the New Testament manuscripts. First of all, these are not errors, but variant readings, the vast majority of which are strictly grammatical, i.e., punctuation and spelling. Second, these readings are spread throughout nearly 5,700 manuscripts, so that a variant spelling of one letter of one word in one verse in 2,000 manuscripts is counted as 2,000 errors. Textual scholars Westcott and Hort estimated that only 1 in 60 of these variants has significance. This would leave a text 98.33% pure. Philip Schaff calculated that of the 150,000 variants known in his day, only 400 changed the meaning of the passage, only 50 were of real significance, and not even one affected an article of faith or a precept of duty which is not abundantly sustained by other and undoubted passages, or by the whole tenor of Scripture teaching. No other ancient book is so well authenticated. The great New Testament scholar and Princeton professor Bruce Metzger estimated that the Mahabharata of Hinduism is copied with only about 90% accuracy, and Homer's Iliad with about 95%. By comparison, he estimated the New Testament is about 99.5% accurate. Again, the 0.5% in question does not affect a single doctrine of the Christian faith. Ancient manuscript authority Frederick Kenyon summed up well the status of the New Testament when he wrote, "It cannot be too strongly asserted that in substance the text of the Bible is certain. Especially is this the case with the New Testament. The number of manuscripts of the New Testament, of early translations from it, and of quotations from it in the oldest writers of the Church, is so large that it is practically certain that the true reading of every doubtful passage is preserved in some one or other of these ancient authorities. This can be said of no other ancient book in the world." So we know we have the same New Testament that was written down nearly 2,000 years ago. But the next question is even more important. Do we have an accurate copy of the truth, or a lie? In other words, is the New Testament historically reliable? Question 2. Is the New Testament historically reliable? When we ask the question, is the New Testament historically reliable, we are seeking to discover if the major events described in the New Testament documents really happened. Specifically, was there really a Jewish man nearly 2,000 years ago by the name of Jesus, who taught profound truths, performed miracles, was crucified by Roman and Jewish authorities for claiming to be God, and who appeared to many witnesses after rising from the dead 3 days later? It is important to keep in mind that at this point we are not seeking to discover if the New Testament is without error or is the Word of God. We are simply trying to discover if the basic storyline is fact, not fiction. In order to discover this, we need to ascertain what kind of records comprise the New Testament. Are they documents written soon after the events by eyewitnesses or by those who interviewed eyewitnesses? Or are they documents written much later by biased followers who simply embellished details about the life of a real historical figure? In order to find out, over the next few chapters, we will test the New Testament documents by criteria historians often use to determine whether or not to believe a given historical document. We'll refer to these criteria as historical tests. They include 1. Do we have early testimony? Generally, the earlier the sources, the more accurate is the testimony. 2. Do we have eyewitness testimony? Eyewitness testimony is usually the best means of establishing what really happened. 3. Do we have testimony from multiple independent eyewitness sources? Multiple independent eyewitnesses confirm that the events really occurred, they are not fiction, and provide additional details that a single source might miss. True independent sources normally tell the same basic story, but with differing details. Historians sometimes call this coherence with dissimilarity. 4. Are the eyewitnesses trustworthy? Should you believe them? Character matters. 5. Do we have corroborating evidence from archaeology or other writers? This adds further confirmation. 6. Do we have any enemy attestation? If opponents of the eyewitnesses admit certain facts the eyewitnesses say are true, then those facts probably are true. For example, if your mother says you are brave, that might be true, but it's probably more credible if your archenemy says the same thing. 7. Does the testimony contain events or details that are embarrassing to the authors? Since most people do not like to record negative information about themselves, any testimony that makes the author look bad is probably true. In most cases, documents that meet most or all of these historical tests are considered trustworthy beyond a reasonable doubt. How do the New Testament documents fare? We'll find out over this chapter and the next three chapters. But before we start at historical test number one, early testimony, we need to clear away some objections that prevent many skeptics from even considering the reliability of the New Testament. Common objections to reliability. History cannot be known. The most recent argument generated against even considering the reliability of the New Testament documents is the assertion that history cannot be known. Ironically, this objection normally comes from the same people who say they know that the first life generated spontaneously from non-living chemicals, and that all subsequent life evolved from that first life without intelligent intervention. They are absolutely sure about that history, despite the fact that there are no eyewitnesses or corroborating data for those events. Yet they assert that the resurrection of Jesus Christ, an event for which there are eyewitnesses and corroborating data, cannot be known. The assertion that history cannot be known is against all common sense. Are we not sure that George Washington was the first president of the United States? That Lincoln was the 16th? That Japan attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941? That the New York Mets won the 1969 World Series? Of course we are. The skeptic is wrong. We can and do know history. In fact, if we can't know history, then we could never detect historical revisionism or historical propaganda, both of which assume there's an objective history that can be known. Why can't someone have knowledge of a past event? The skeptic may say, because you don't have access to all the facts. To which we respond, then scientists can't know anything either because they don't have access to all the facts. This is obviously absurd. While we don't have access to all the facts, we may be able to gather enough of them to be reasonably certain about what happened. Part of the confusion involves a failure to define what it means to know. Since we can't go back in time and witness historical events again, our historical knowledge is based on probability. In other words, we use the same standard a jury uses to determine if a defendant committed a crime, beyond a reasonable doubt. If history cannot be known, then no jury could ever reach a verdict. After all, a jury makes a judgment about the guilt or innocence of someone based on knowledge of some past event. Historians must discover past events, just like police and forensic scientists do, by piecing together evidence and interviewing eyewitnesses. And when they do, they often use the seven historical tests we've just identified above. Finally, if we cannot know history, then skeptics cannot claim that Christianity is untrue. To say that Christianity is untrue, the skeptic must know history. Why? Because every negation implies an affirmation. To say that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, the negation, the skeptic must know what actually did happen to him, the affirmation. In the end, skeptics are caught in a dilemma. If they say history cannot be known, then they lose the ability to say evolution is true and Christianity is false. If they admit history can be known, then they must deal with the multiple lines of historical evidence for creation and Christianity. The New Testament documents contain miracles. Skeptics usually charge, the New Testament contains miracles, therefore much of it has to be legend. We've already answered that objection. Since God exists, miracles are possible. And as we'll see in chapter 13, the events of the New Testament are in a context where miracles are not only possible, but were predicted. So the inclusion of miracles does not negate the historicity of the New Testament documents, but may actually strengthen their historicity, because they record predicted events. The New Testament writers were biased. The great skeptic David Hume said witnesses should be unbiased if we're going to consider them credible. So when the skeptics look at the New Testament documents, they often ask, "How can you say they are reliable when they were written by the converted? These are biased accounts written by biased people." It's true that the New Testament writers were biased and converted people, but that doesn't mean they lied or exaggerated. Indeed, their conversion and bias may have actually driven them to be more accurate. Let's see why. A few years ago, a so-called documentary about Jesus on a cable TV channel led off with this comment from the narrator. Most of what we think we know about Jesus comes from the New Testament Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But we can't trust those books for accurate information because they were written by the converted. Now, what's wrong with that logic? What's wrong with that logic is that it fails to ask the most important question. Why were they converted? Indeed, the first and most important question is not, what were the beliefs of the New Testament writers? The first and most important question is, why did they convert to these new beliefs? In other words, why did the New Testament writers suddenly abandon their livelihoods and treasured religious traditions for these new beliefs? I, Frank, posed that question to a couple of black Muslims during a radio debate not long ago. Like traditional Muslims, black Muslims do not believe that Jesus went to the cross, so there's no way he could have resurrected. With this in mind, I asked them, why did the New Testament writers suddenly convert from Judaism to believing that Jesus rose from the dead? One of them said, because they wanted power over the people. I said, what power did the New Testament writers gain by asserting that Jesus rose from the dead? The answer is none. In fact, instead of gaining power, they got exactly the opposite. Submission, servitude, persecution, torture, and death. They had no answer. I then asked them the question in a different way. What possible motive did the New Testament writers have to make up the resurrection story if it wasn't true? Again, they had no response. Why? Because they began to realize that the New Testament writers had every earthly motive to deny the resurrection rather than proclaim it. There was no motive or incentive to make up the New Testament storyline. The last time we checked, the promise of submission, servitude, persecution, torture, and death would not motivate anyone to make up such a story. The New Testament writers certainly had no reason to make up a new religion. We must remember that all of them, with the possible exception of Luke, were Jews who firmly believed they already had the one true religion. And that nearly 2,000-year-old religion asserted that they, the Jews, were the chosen people of God. Why would the Jews who converted to Christianity risk persecution, death, and perhaps eternal damnation to start something that, one, wasn't true, and two, elevated non-Jews into the exclusive relationship they claimed to have with the Creator of the universe? And unless the resurrection actually happened, why would they almost immediately stop observing the Sabbath, circumcision, the law of Moses, the centrality of the temple, the priestly system, and other Old Testament teachings? The New Testament writers had to have witnessed some very strong evidence to turn away from those ancient beliefs and practices that had defined who they and their forebears were for nearly 2,000 years. Converted people are not objective. At this point, the skeptic might protest, but since the New Testament writers were converted, they can't be objective. Nonsense. People can be objective even when they aren't neutral. A doctor can give an objective diagnosis even if he has strong feelings for the patient. That is, he can be objective even though he isn't neutral. In fact, his passion for the patient may cause him to be all the more diligent in diagnosing and then treating the disease properly. In writing this book, while we certainly aren't neutral, we are presenting objective facts. Likewise, atheists are not neutral, but they too can present objective facts, if they decide to. The New Testament writers could do the same. The truth of the matter is that all books are written for a reason, and most authors believe what they are writing. But that doesn't mean what they write is wrong or has no objective element. As we mentioned in the preface, the survivors of the Holocaust who wrote down their experiences certainly were not neutral bystanders. They believed passionately in recording those events so that the world would never forget the Holocaust and hopefully never repeat it. While passion may cause some people to exaggerate, it may drive others to be all the more meticulous and accurate so as not to lose credibility and acceptance of the message they wish to communicate. This distinction between the neutrality and the objectivity of the New Testament writers is an extremely important point. Too often, the documents that make up the New Testament are automatically considered biased and untrustworthy. This is ironic, because those who hold this view are often biased themselves. They are biased because they have not first investigated the New Testament documents, or the context in which they were written, in order to make an educated assessment of their trustworthiness. As we're about to see, the New Testament documents are not church propaganda, or a monolith of writings designed to promote some church-manufactured theology. What are they, then? That's the question we'll address in the remainder of this chapter and the next three. So let's get started. We know we have an accurate copy of what was written down by the New Testament writers, but are those documents trustworthy? Our first question deals with historical test number one. Are the New Testament documents early? Are the New Testament documents early? Yes. How early? All New Testament books were written before A.D. 100, about 70 years after the death of Jesus. As Table 9.1 shows, in letters written between A.D. 95 and 110, three early church fathers, Clement, Ignatius, and Polycarp, quoted passages out of 25 of the 27 books in the New Testament. Only the short books of Jude and 2 John were not referenced, but they certainly had been written. Jude had written his short letter by this time because, being Jesus' half-brother, he was almost certainly dead by A.D. 100. And 2 John had been written because it came before 3 John, which was one of the 25 books quoted. New Testament documents cited by Clement, writing from Rome, circa A.D. 95. Matthew, Mark, Luke, Romans, 1 Corinthians, Ephesians, 1 Timothy, Titus, Hebrews, James, 1 Peter. Ignatius, writing from Smyrna in Asia Minor, circa 107. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 Thessalonians, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon, Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, 1 John, 3 John, Revelation. Polycarp, writing from Smyrna in Asia Minor, circa 110. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 2 Thessalonians, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Hebrews, 1 Peter, 1 John. Since Clement was in Rome and Ignatius and Polycarp were hundreds of miles away in Smyrna, the original New Testament documents had to have been written significantly earlier, otherwise they could not have circulated across the ancient world by that time. Therefore, it's safe to say that all of the New Testament was written by A.D. 100, and at least those in the left column several years before 95. But that's just the latest they could have been written. Most were probably written much earlier. How much earlier? Most, if not all, before 70. Most, if not all, of these books were written before A.D. 70, about 40 years after the death of Jesus. Imagine this. You're a devout Jew in the first century. The center of your national, economic, and religious life is Jerusalem, and especially the temple. It has been that way in your nation, your family, and almost every Jew's family for 1,000 years, ever since Solomon built the first temple. Most of the newest temple, constructed by King Herod, was completed when you were a child, but portions of it are still under construction and have been since 19 BC. For your entire life you have attended services and brought sacrifices there to atone for the sins you've committed against God. Why? Because you and your countrymen consider this temple the earthly dwelling place of the God of the universe, the maker of heaven and earth, the very deity whose name is so holy you dare not utter it. As a young man, you begin following a Jew named Jesus, who claims to be the long-awaited Messiah predicted in your scriptures. He performs miracles, teaches profound truths, and scolds and befuddles the priests in charge of the temple. Incredibly, he predicts his own death and resurrection. He also predicts that the temple itself will be destroyed before your generation passes away. Mark chapter 13, verses 2 and 30. This is scandalous. Jesus is convicted of blasphemy by your temple priests and is crucified on the eve of the Passover, one of your holiest holidays, He's buried in a Jewish tomb, but 3 days later, you and his other followers see Jesus alive, just as he predicted. You touch him, eat with him, and he continues to perform miracles, the last being his ascension into heaven. 40 years later, your temple is destroyed, just as Jesus had predicted, along with the entire city and thousands of your countrymen. Question. If you and your fellow followers write accounts of Jesus after the temple and city were destroyed in A.D. 70, aren't you going to at least mention that unprecedented national, human, economic, and religious tragedy somewhere in your writings? Especially since this risen Jesus had predicted it? Of course. Well, here's the problem for those who say the New Testament was written after 70. There's absolutely no mention of the fulfillment of this predicted tragedy anywhere in the New Testament documents. This means most, if not all, of the documents must have been written prior to 70. Some may object, that's an argument from silence, and that doesn't prove anything. But in fact, it is not an argument from silence, for the New Testament documents speak of Jerusalem and the temple, or activities associated with them, as if they were still intact at the time of the writings. But even if this were an argument from silence, that doesn't mean it's wrong. Consider these modern parallels. If a former sailor aboard the USS Arizona wrote a book related to the history of that ship, and the book ends with no mention of the ship being sunk, and 1,177 of its sailors being killed at Pearl Harbor, do you have any doubt that the book must have been written prior to December 7, 1941? Or, if a former tenant of the World Trade Center wrote a book related to the history of those buildings, and the book ends with the towers still standing, there's absolutely no mention of the towers being destroyed and nearly 3,000 people being murdered by Muslim terrorists, do you have any doubt that the book must have been written prior to September 11, 2001? Of course not. Well, the disaster in AD 70, in terms of lives, property, and national scope, was many magnitudes greater than Pearl Harbor and 9/11. It marked the end of such a terrible war that Josephus, who himself surrendered to the Romans in 67, called it the greatest war of all time. The Jews didn't lose just one ship or a couple of prominent buildings. They lost their entire country, their capital city, and their temple, which had been the center of their religious, political, and economic life for the last 1,000 years. In addition, tens of thousands of their countrymen were dead, and hundreds of their villages burned to the ground. So, if we would expect tragedies such as Pearl Harbor and 9/11 to be mentioned in the relevant writings of today, we certainly should expect the events of A.D. 70 to be cited somewhere in the New Testament, especially since the events were predicted by Jesus. But since the New Testament does not mention these events anywhere, and suggests that Jerusalem and the temple are still intact, we can conclude, reasonably, that most, if not all, of the New Testament documents must have been written prior to 70. How much earlier? Many New Testament books were composed before A.D. 62, about 30 years after the death of Jesus. Imagine this. You are a first-century medical doctor who has embarked on a research project to record the events of the early church. This research will require you to interview eyewitnesses of the early church and to travel with the Apostle Paul as he visits new churches across the ancient world. You record prominent events in the life of the church, such as the early work of John and Peter, as well as the martyrdoms of Stephen and James, the brother of John. In Paul's life, you record everything from sermons, beatings, and trials to shipwrecks and imprisonments. You also record his theological summit with Peter and James, who is Jesus' brother and the leader of the church in Jerusalem. As you describe many of these events, your narrative is so filled with details that every informed reader will know that either you must have access to eyewitness testimony, or you are an eyewitness yourself. For example, as you follow Paul on his travels, you shift from using the pronoun they to we, and you correctly record the names of local politicians, local slang, local weather patterns, local topography, local business practices. You even record the right depth of the water about a quarter mile off Malta, as your ship is about to run aground in a storm. In fact, you record at least 84 such details in the last half of your narrative. Question. Since you obviously find it important to record all of these minor details, if your main subject, the Apostle Paul, was executed at the hands of the Roman Emperor Nero, do you think you would record it? Or if Jesus' brother, the leader of the church in Jerusalem, was killed at the hands of the Sanhedrin, the same Jewish body that sentenced Jesus to die? Do you think you would record it? Of course! And if you failed to record such momentous events, we would rightly assume that you wrote your narrative before their deaths. This is the situation we find in the New Testament. Luke, the medical doctor, meticulously records all kinds of details in Acts, which chronicles the early church. A listing of 84 historically confirmed details is in the next chapter. Luke records the deaths of two Christian martyrs, Stephen and James, the brother of John, but his account ends with two of its primary leaders, Paul and James, the brother of Jesus, still living. Acts ends abruptly with Paul under house arrest in Rome, and there's no mention of James having died. We know from Clement of Rome, writing in the late 1st century, and from other early church fathers, that Paul was executed sometime during the reign of Nero, which ended in AD 68. And we know from Josephus that James was killed in 62. So we can conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the book of Acts was written before 62. If you're still not convinced, consider this modern parallel. Suppose someone wrote a book recording the events surrounding the main figures of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. The book begins with the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and includes the civil rights legislation of 1964, the marches and protests of Martin Luther King Jr., including his arrest and imprisonment, and his great I Have a Dream speech on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Question. If the book ends with Martin Luther King Jr., the very leader of the movement, still alive, when would you conclude that the book was written? Obviously, before his assassination in April of 1968. This is the same situation we have with Luke's narrative. His book ends with the main leaders still alive, which means it was written no later than 62. Classical scholar and historian Colin Hamer gives 13 additional reasons why Acts was written by 62. If Acts was written by 62, then the Gospel of Luke was written before that. How do we know? Because Luke reminds the original recipient of Acts, Theophilus, who was probably an important Roman official, that he had written to him earlier. The first verse of Acts says, "In my former book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and to teach." The former book must be the Gospel of Luke, because Luke addresses that to Theophilus as well. Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, see citation below. How much earlier is Luke? It would seem reasonable to place Luke at or before AD 60. Why? Because 62 is the latest Acts was written, and there had to have been some time between Luke's first writing to Theophilus and his second. If Acts is no later than 62, and quite possibly earlier, then Luke is realistically 60 or before. This date also makes sense in light of Paul's quotation of Luke's Gospel. Writing sometime between AD 62 to 65, Paul quotes from Luke chapter 10, verse 7, and calls it Scripture. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 18. Therefore, Luke's gospel must have been in circulation long enough before that time in order for both Paul and Timothy to know its contents and regard it as scripture. By the way, this was no minor claim for Paul to make. In effect, he was making the bold assertion that Luke's gospel was just as inspired as the Holy Jewish Bible, the Old Testament he treasured so much. If Luke was written by AD 60, then Mark must have been written in the mid to late 50s, if not earlier. Why? Because Luke says that he got his facts by checking with eyewitness sources. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. Most scholars believe Mark's gospel was one of those eyewitness sources. And if those Dead Sea Scroll fragments we mentioned above are really from AD 50 to 70, then certainly Mark is earlier. But even if Mark is not before Luke, the very fact that we know beyond a reasonable doubt that Luke is before 62 and probably before 60 means that we have meticulously recorded eyewitness testimony written within 25 or 30 years of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. This is far too early to be legendary. It also means that the eyewitness sources go back even earlier. How much earlier? Some New Testament books were penned in the 40s and 50s AD with sources from the 30s, only a few years after the death of Jesus. As certain as we are about the date of Luke's records, there is no doubt from anyone, including the most liberal of scholars, that Paul wrote his first letter to the church at Corinth, which is in modern-day Greece, sometime between 55 and 56. In this letter, Paul speaks about moral problems in the church and then proceeds to discuss controversies over tongues, prophecies, and the Lord's Supper. This, of course, demonstrates that the church in Corinth was experiencing some kind of miraculous activity and was already observing the Lord's Supper within 25 years of the resurrection. But the most significant aspect of this letter is that it contains the earliest and most authenticated testimony of the resurrection itself. In the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul writes down the testimony he received from others and the testimony that was authenticated when Christ appeared to him. "For I delivered to you, as of first importance, what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, Peter, then to the 12. After that he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as it were to one untimely born, he appeared to me also." 1 Corinthians chapter 15 verses 3 to 8, NASB. Where did Paul get what he received? He probably received it from Peter and James when he visited them in Jerusalem 3 years after his conversion. Galatians chapter 1, verse 18. Why is this important? Because, as Gary Habermas points out, most scholars, even liberals, believe that this testimony was part of an early creed that dates right back to the resurrection itself, 18 months to 8 years after, but some say even earlier. There is no possible way that such testimony could describe a legend, because it goes right back to the time and place of the event itself. If there was ever a place that a legendary resurrection could not occur, it was Jerusalem, because the Jews and the Romans were all too eager to squash Christianity, and could have easily done so by parading Jesus' body around the city. Moreover, notice that Paul cites 14 eyewitnesses whose names are known. The 12 apostles, James, and Paul himself. Cephas is the Aramaic for Peter. And then references an appearance to more than 500 others at one time. Included in those groups was one skeptic, James, and one outright enemy, Paul himself. By naming so many people who could verify what Paul was saying, Paul was, in effect, challenging his Corinthian readers to check him out. Bible scholar William Lilly puts it this way. What gives a special authority to the list as historical evidence is the reference to most of the 500 brethren being still alive. St. Paul says, in effect, "If you do not believe me, you can ask them." Such a statement in an admittedly genuine letter written within 30 years of the event is almost as strong evidence as one could hope to get for something that happened nearly 2,000 years ago. If the resurrection had not occurred, why would Paul give such a list of supposed eyewitnesses? He would have immediately lost all credibility with his Corinthian readers by lying so blatantly. In addition to 1 Corinthians, there are numerous other New Testament documents that were written in the 50s or earlier. Galatians, AD 48, 1 Thessalonians, 50-54, and Romans, 57-58, are all in this category. In fact, and we know we may be going out on a limb here, all of Paul's works had to have been written before he died, which was sometime in the mid-60s. But it's not just conservative scholars who believe these early dates. Even some radical critics, such as atheist John A.T. Robinson, admit the New Testament documents were written early. Known for his role in launching the Death of God movement, Robinson wrote a revolutionary book titled Redating the New Testament, in which he posited that most New Testament books, including all four Gospels, were written sometime between A.D. 40 and 65. The great and once liberal archaeologist William F. Albright, after seeing how well the New Testament fit with the archaeological and historical data, wrote, "We can already say emphatically that there is no longer any solid basis for dating any book of the New Testament after about A.D. 80. Elsewhere, Albright said, "In my opinion, every book of the New Testament was written by a baptized Jew between the 40s and the 80s of the first century, very probably sometime between about A.D. 50 and 75. So we know beyond a reasonable doubt that most, if not all, of the New Testament documents are early. But skeptics still have a couple of objections. Skeptics advocate: the documents are not early enough. Some skeptics may think that a 15 to 40 year gap between the life of Christ and the writings about him is too wide for the testimony to be reliable, but they are mistaken. Think about events that occurred 15 to 40 years ago. When historians write about those events, we don't say, "Oh, that's impossible. No one can remember events from that long ago." Such skepticism is clearly unwarranted. Historians today write accurately about events in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s by consulting their own memories, those of other eyewitnesses, and any written sources from the time. This process is the same one the New Testament writers use to record their documents. Like a good reporter, Luke interviewed eyewitnesses. And as we'll see in the next chapter, some New Testament writers were eyewitnesses themselves. They could remember 15 to 40-year-old events quite easily, just as you can. Why can you remember certain events vividly from 15 to 40 years ago, and if you're old enough, even further back? You may be able to remember certain events because they made a great emotional impact on you. In fact, those of us who are over the hill can remember some events from 30 years ago better than those from 30 minutes ago. Where were you and what were you doing when President Kennedy was assassinated, when the Challenger exploded, when the second plane hit the tower? Why can you remember those events so well? Because they made a deep emotional impact on you. Since an event like the resurrection certainly would have made a deep emotional impact on the New Testament writers and the other eyewitnesses they may have consulted, it's easy to see why the history of Jesus could be easily recalled many years later, especially in a culture with an established reliance on oral testimony. More on this below. Furthermore, if the major works of the New Testament are eyewitness accounts written within two generations of the events, then they are not likely to be legend. Why? Because historical research indicates that a myth cannot begin to crowd out historical facts while the eyewitnesses are still alive. For this reason, Roman historian A.N. Sherwin White calls the mythological view of the New Testament unbelievable. William Lane Craig writes, "The tests show that even two generations is too short to allow legendary tendencies to wipe out the hard core of historical fact. Inside of those two generations, eyewitnesses are still around to correct the errors of historical revisionists." We are seeing this tendency right now with regard to the Holocaust. In the early 21st century, we've begun to see more people claim that the Holocaust never happened. Why are the revisionists trying this now? Because most of the eyewitnesses have now died. Fortunately, since we have written eyewitness testimony from the Holocaust, the revisionists are not successful in passing off their lies as the truth. The same holds true for the New Testament. If the New Testament was written within 60 years of the events it records, it is highly unlikely those events could be legendary. And as we have seen, all of the New Testament documents were written within 60 years of the events, and many much earlier. Why not earlier? At this point, the skeptic might say, okay, fine. The New Testament is early, but it's not as early as I would expect. Why didn't they write down their testimony earlier? If I saw what they said they saw, I wouldn't wait 15 or 20 years to write it down. There are a number of possible reasons for the wait. First, since the New Testament writers were living in a culture where the vast majority of people were illiterate, there was no initial need or utility in writing it down. First century people in Palestine, by necessity, developed strong memories in order to remember and pass on information. Craig writes, in an oral culture like that of first century Palestine, the ability to memorize and retain large tracts of oral tradition was a highly prized and highly developed skill. From the earliest age, children in the home, elementary school, and the synagogue were taught to memorize faithfully sacred tradition. The disciples would have exercised similar care with the teachings of Jesus. In such an oral culture, facts about Jesus may have been put into a memorable form. There's good evidence for this. Gary Habermas has identified 41 short sections of the New Testament that appear to be creeds, compact sayings that could easily be remembered and that were probably passed along orally before they were put into writing. One of these creeds we've already mentioned, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 to 8. Second, since some of the New Testament writers may have had high hopes that Jesus was going to come back in their lifetime, they saw no immediate need to write it down. But as they aged, perhaps they thought it wise to put their observations down on papyrus. Third, as Christianity spread all over the ancient world, writing became the most efficient means to communicate with the rapidly expanding church. In other words, time and distance forced the New Testament writers to write it down. On the other hand, there may not have been a gap for at least one gospel. If those fragments from the Dead Sea Scrolls are really from Mark, and they most likely are, then that gospel might have been written in the 30s. Why? Because the fragments are of copies, not of the original. If we have copies from the 50s, then the original must have been earlier. Moreover, many scholars believe there actually were written sources that predate the Gospels. In fact, Luke, in the first four verses of his Gospel, says that he checked with other sources, though some of these may have been earlier Gospels, for example, Matthew and Mark. Was one of his sources Mark's Gospel? We don't know for sure. It certainly seems like Luke is speaking of several other written sources, because he says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. Luke chapter 1, verse 1. Luke may have referenced Mark's gospel and other written testimonies, including public court records from Jesus' trial. In the end, it doesn't really matter whether or not there were written sources that predate the New Testament. Nor does it matter if Mark was written in the 30s A.D. Why? Because the documents we do know about are early enough and contain early source material. As we'll see in the next chapter, many if not all of the New Testament documents were written by eyewitnesses or their contemporaries within 15 to 40 years of Jesus, and some contain oral or other written testimony that goes back to the resurrection itself. In other words, the real issue isn't so much the date of writings, but the date of the sources used in the writings. Why not more? Skeptics may ask, if Jesus actually did rise from the dead, shouldn't there be more written about him than there is? In response, we actually have more testimony than we might expect, and certainly more than enough to establish beyond a reasonable doubt what happened. As we have seen, Jesus is referenced by far more authors than the Roman emperor at the time. Jesus' 43 authors to Tiberius's 10 within 150 years of their lives. 9 of those authors were eyewitnesses or contemporaries of the events, and they wrote 27 documents, the majority of which mention or imply the resurrection. That's more than enough to establish historicity. For those who still think there should have been even more written about Jesus, New Testament scholar Craig Blumberg offers 4 reasons why that's not a reasonable expectation. 1. the humble beginnings of Christianity. 2. The remote location of Palestine on the eastern frontiers of the Roman Empire. 3. The small percentage of the works of ancient Greco-Roman historians that have survived. This could be due to loss, decay, destruction, or all of the above. And 4. The lack of attention paid by surviving historical documents to Jewish figures in general. Nevertheless, some skeptics still think there should be testimony from some of the 500 people who allegedly saw the risen Christ. Skeptic Farrell Till is one of them. During a debate on the resurrection that I, Norm, had with him in 1994, Till demanded, "Trot out one of those 500 witnesses or give us something that they wrote, and we will accept that as reliable proof or evidence." This is an unreasonable expectation for a number of reasons. First, as we have already pointed out, first-century Palestine was an oral culture. Most people were illiterate and remembered and passed on information orally. Second, how many of those predominantly illiterate eyewitnesses would have written something even if they could write? Even today, with a much higher literacy rate and all the conveniences of modern writing and research tools, how many people do you know who have written a book or even an article on any subject? How many do you know who have written a book or article on a contemporary historical event, even a significant event like 9/11? Probably not many, and certainly fewer than 1 out of 500. Has Farrell Till ever written an article on a major historical event he witnessed? Third, even if some of those 500 average people did write down what they saw, why would skeptics expect their testimony to survive for 2,000 years? The New Testament survives intact because of the thousands of manuscripts copied by scribes for a growing church over the centuries. Historical works from the major ancient historians such as Josephus, Tacitus, and Pliny survive on just a handful of copies, and those copies are hundreds of years from the originals. Why do the skeptics think anything is going to be written, much less survive, from an ancient group of illiterate Galilean peasants? Finally, we do know the names of many of the 500, and their testimony is written down in the New Testament. They include Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Peter, Paul, and James, plus 9 who are named elsewhere as apostles, Matthew chapter 10 and Acts chapter 1. So we shouldn't expect more testimony than what we have about Jesus, and what we do have is more than enough to establish historicity. Summary and conclusion. We have much more to investigate regarding the historicity of the New Testament, but we can draw 2 major conclusions at this point. 1. We have an accurate copy of the original New Testament documents. A. While the original New Testament documents do not survive or have not yet been found, we have abundant and accurate copies of the original New Testament documents. Many more than that for the 10 best pieces of ancient literature combined. Moreover, nearly perfect reconstruction of the originals can be accomplished by comparing the thousands of manuscript copies that do survive. We have discovered manuscript fragments from the early 2nd century and perhaps as early as the mid-1st century. There are no works from the ancient world that even come close to the New Testament in terms of manuscript support. B. Reconstruction is further authenticated by the thousands of quotations from the early church fathers. In fact, the entire New Testament, except for 11 verses, can be reconstructed just from their quotations of it. 2. The New Testament documents are early and contain even earlier source material. A. Since the New Testament documents are referenced by other writers by about AD 100, they had to have been composed before then. B. Since the New Testament documents speak as if the temple and the city were still standing at the time of their writing, and there is no mention of the onset of the Jewish war or the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, most of the New Testament documents are probably earlier than AD 70. C. We have very strong evidence that Acts was written by 62, which means Luke is even earlier. D. We have source material that goes back into the 30s. Nearly all scholars agree that the death, burial, and resurrection testimony found in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 comes from the time of those events or within a few years of them. Furthermore, there are at least 40 other creeds in the New Testament that appear to be of very early origin. So the documents are early and the sources are even earlier. But that's not enough to prove historicity beyond a reasonable doubt. To prove historicity, we need to be sure that these documents really contain eyewitness testimony. Do they? That's the question we'll investigate next.